There we go.
No, we're not doing the live stream yet. We're starting some right.
Well, now we're just
weird things going on.
We've been jammed. I think we've been jammed by the
gym owners. Jammed by Putin?
Never happens.
Well, I don't know. Jellyfied by Putin. You know, that sounds like something we haven't seen.
Science from the
Oh, we do.
We would not want to rupture any of the nuclear plans.
All right, we always let the Morocco players go for a few minutes.
Yes, it's always good to let them go because they're on salary. Yeah.
All right, hey, hopefully that's enough of the music now.
That was fabulous. Hey, good morning, Mr. Richard Pollack.
Good morning, Robert Strong.
Hey, this is Radio Science News, February 26th, 2022. This is episode number 827 in a series.
Ooh, wait a minute.
And if you're a prime number fan out there, hold on to your giblets. This really is a prime number.
Oh, wow.
And just to keep you intrigued, if you tune in for episode number 829 in 2 weeks on March 12th, that is also a prime number, meaning that March 12th and today, February 26th, are twin primes, which I know that you're as excited as I am about that.
Well, I would be more excited if it actually just were March 12th. That would even be better for me, I think.
Yeah, well, I'm so sorry to hear that, but it's not. It is February 26, 2022. And before we get going, we have a guest with us in the audience here. We oftentimes have, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people here. They're usually very, very quiet, so you don't hear them. But we have one of our good friends here, and I'm going to let him introduce himself. And he has a interesting
breaking news announcement.
Yeah, more or less broken news. Anyway, I'm Father Michael. I have been the priest over in Martin's Ferry the last 6 years, the Orthodox Church there. And as of tomorrow, I am retiring and disappearing back into the forest at the monastery. But I have been interested here for the last 6 years with being able to breathe the air and drink the water. And the news this week was that our great economic opportunity of the ethane cracker plant in Dillis Bottom on the Ohio side isn't going to be happening right away. In fact, the Asian-owned company that has been trying to do this actually allowed their air permit to expire. So they got their permit to emit whatever they were going to emit, and they had a period of time, 2 years, 3 years, something like that, that they had to get started on the project. And they didn't do that. And then they got an extension. And they tried, and they couldn't. Basically, they've said there is no economically viable way for us to make a profit producing toxic plastics in the Ohio Valley. So we're just going to let this thing expire. And they're not saying they won't do it, they're just not going to get around to it. And if they don't happen to go forward with emitting 1,785,043 tons of greenhouse gas.
That's a lot of greenhouse gas.
Well, the spokesperson says the company is committed to mitigating climate change. So they recognize that there is climate change and something should be done about it. But I do find it difficult to see how adding a ton every 18 seconds is helping the situation.
Going to fix the situation.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah.
So they haven't officially said that they will never do this. They just let their permits expire And when asked recently, could we be part of the at the table in discussing how to go forward in a good way, the local environmentalists were told, there is no table to be at right now. We have no economic way of doing this. There's not the funding for it.
Well, if there's no economic funding a pathway forward now, I don't think there's going to be one.
Well the exciting part is trying to figure out now, okay, once we admit that we're not going to bring in Tyrannosaurus rexus to devour everything here, what would be other ways of going forward with a healthy economy?
What a great idea.
Here in the valley.
Well, that would be a table I think many of us would be happy to sit at.
I would love to be on that.
Well, there are some groups around, Ohio Valley Institute and other people, that are looking at really interesting ideas of how to do that. It seems that Ohio State University and West Virginia University are now teaming up with these people to come forward and start looking at alternatives to burning the resource or turning it into toxic materials.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, that's great. And I'm going to, we actually have one of those topics today that we might not have noticed yet, but we're going to be talking about
the hydrogen,
the so-called hydrogen hub funding, which is, but it's like, this reminds me a little bit of something Robert and I have talked about for years and years, the fact that West Virginia and the region with its coal, if they were not to burn it, could actually do amazing clean things with it if they had to do anything at all. Or the amount of things that could occur by reclaiming even giant gob piles of stuff.
The potential there is tremendous. When you think that the highest point in Belmont County, Ohio, is the gob pile behind Murray Mines, which is now closed down because there's no more profitable coal to extract. And the highest point in Jefferson County is the Apex landfill.
Mount Apex!
Being added to daily by train loads of trash from New Jersey.
Really? New Jersey trash?
Yeah, ooh, New Jersey and nice. New York City trash. Yeah, they bring it in by the train load.
Wow.
And one wonders what the economics of living in New York or New Jersey would be if
they weren't allowed to.
They
do
had
if
they actually
if they actually
with
dealt
it.
With their own rather
right.
than
yeah.
just say no,
that
thank you. We don't need any more of your toxic waste.
Aww.
These are big questions. These could be five different shows.
Yes.
It's true. But what have you got there on hydrogen?
Well, okay. Well, so, you know, Robert, get here, us to the let, folks to there. Well, then we'll talk
the,
about it
to the webpage
we'll,
there.
We'll just talk about that right off.
If you folks are tuning in, this is Radio Science News, episode number 827 in a series. Prime number, if you want to check on that.
If you're betting. 26,
if you're a betting man, yes.
Bet this one on you. I'm going to punch a prime number into my my Powerball today.
It's this February 26, 2022, and we're about to go to the launch pad of science. If you will, if you'll go to my favorite webpage on the internet, which is smartcenter.org, www.smartcenter.org, smartcenter.org. And just above the little trifecta rainbows of the t-shirts that Richard lovingly went out and got made for us years and years ago, he then scanned those in, and I just think they're gorgeous. Just above that is the link to Radio Science News, the launch pad of science, and I get to see it now for the first time in my humanistic existence.
Oh, there it goes. I was worried.
My page is going real slow. We've got DST.
Yeah. It sounds like a serious drug problem, but it's
it
actually
probably
only
is.
It's only daylight savings
time. Oh, which is a serious drug problem. Yes. I'm so glad that you put that up because I need to rant, and that's what I rant about best is daylight savings.
We'll let you get to that in a second.
We will indeed. And then there's Ukraine.
Donbass.
And the Donbass. SpaceX. Hey, if you're not having fun, you're not doing SpaceX. Hydrogen Hub. That's what Michael here wants to talk about a little bit. Chilling.
Sub-dwarfs. Hey, who are you calling a sub-dwarf?
As if they aren't small enough, there are sub-dwarfs. Then there's C. diff. We have been speaking about that every now and then. Brain Song.
Brain Song.
Hmm. That's interesting. Math neurons. That sounds fun. Methane, yeah. Always a winner.
Always timely.
Then weavers, virus, graphene, ooh, and the chart.
There's a chart too. But because we are talking about sort of interesting local things, and gosh, what could you do otherwise? I did run across, actually, this is a frustrating topic for me, Robert, because I can recall not only you, but...
A hydrogen hub?
But myself. Let's go to hydrogen hub.
Hydrogen
let's just
hub.
Get
let's
the basis for the, let's hope, maybe just brief discussion we'll have here. Hydrogen hub. Oh, it's from, wait a minute, it's from Joe Manchin, what was this, the Senate.gov. This
so
is a big
this
press
is
release.
Manchin, Capito, McKinley... Justice announced launch of West Virginia Hydrogen Hub Working Group.
Wow.
West Virginia leaders will collaborate to compete for a new hydrogen hub funded by the bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Wait a minute. If this is bipartisan, Manchin is a Democrat.
Yeah.
Capito is a Republican. McKinley is a Republican. And Justice, he used to be a Democrat and is now a Republican. So I guess that really
it's like almost tripartisan.
Yeah, it's almost tripartisan. Yeah.
Probably tripartisan.
And all I'm going to say is I do appreciate this. One of the things I do appreciate is the fact that though very few people did support the infrastructure thing, even though we've all asked for infrastructure improvement decade upon decade in both parties.
Right, we sure have.
I do find it I'm not even going to criticize the fact that they're taking credit for it as a bipartisan thing. We've got three, and because I understand, I mean, I haven't been paying as close attention as I might, but I know that Delegate McKinley is under extreme pressure and fire because he went along and did something good for his state.
How dare he?
He was one of 10, I think, 10 delegates that voted for it in the House. Anyway, the gist of it is, Robert, they're talking about something that I had not heard much. Now, of course, this is a working, this is like a working group.
Mm-hmm.
To collaborate and support a strong, West Virginia as a state is a strong candidate to be chosen to develop a hydrogen hub funded by $9.5 billion
That's
allocated to the
billions.
U.S. Department of Energy by the bipartisan, and they're saying it again because we want to know that,
right.
Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. I would just recommend go back and look at the specific Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and see what various people said about it, and then vote for the people that supported it.
Right.
Major energy producing facility tied with end-use partners to create good-paying long-term jobs and lead in the advancement of this critical technology in the coming weeks and months. The group will add partners and host an initial organizational meeting. Now, we're going to let everybody else just kind of read it because everybody's proud about the wonderful things that will come from it. And, you know, I'm looking at Senator Manchin's statement, and at Key Part, and West Virginia is well positioned to continue as a leader in energy innovation. You know, these things sound wonderful to me.
They do.
I'm just going to say, in terms of the conversation that we might have at some later time, that one of the first things that Robert mentioned to me when we were talking about, if they're going to do natural gas production, we were saying, you know, they should look at, first of all, maybe the possibility that they would extract helium, which is something.
Yeah,
they haven't mentioned
that.
Do not
throw that away.
but the other thing that we looked at was the fact that if you could actually have a hydrogen infrastructure, you could maybe eliminate, even if you were to put in all kinds of pipelines and you could get past the problems of leaking and brittleizing of the structures.
And there is a way around that.
Which we have talked about with some of
over and over again.
Manchin's folks, particularly a company named MagnaGas that has all hydrogen-based fuels that surprisingly can be derived from like treating waste materials. Like every sewage treatment plant in the state of West Virginia could be producing hydrogen-based fuels and sterile water and
at
sterile soil.
Even, at the same time.
Even if they were taking it from New Jersey, by the way.
Mm-hmm. And New Jersey soils.
And so we pushed for that. Now, the other part that makes it really a fascinating thing is that the technology, which again, I said, we'll talk about it some later date, it addresses the fact that hydrogen being a tiny little, a natural molecule of hydrogen, will just be so tiny, Robert. Because it exists as H2 in the natural state, that it gets into the lattice structure of metals and brittleizes them, causing them to fail and break. And also, any tiny little crack or hole, it basically leaks out.
Just goes right through.
The other problem is you just have H2, whereas the technology of a company called Magna Gas, and folks can look it up, or we'll talk about it later, has actually looked at a process whereby the extreme magnetic fields in the vortices of these carbon arc things that they use to treat with causes hydrogen to take on what they call a magnecular attraction. In other words, it's lightly attracted to another molecule. So instead of just H2, sitting there, it's like a stack of magnets that you might get at the smart center.
H2, which seems to be stacked to another H2, stacked to another H2, to another, and they are looking that this might have a molecular mass of H14.
In other words, this kind of a hydrogen technology would be the basis would understand how that worked. So we'll actually pursue it, and who knows, maybe Robert, you never know, they're going to have an organizational meeting.
So I just want to say Senator Manchin, Senator Capito, Representative McKinley, and of course Jim Bob Justice. If you want us on the team, we got the solutions for you.
Well,
give us a call. We're there because we want to make West Virginia as good as it can possibly be.
That's right.
I mean.
All right.
There you go.
He either said amen said I'm in. Either way is good for me. Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, we're going to jump in. There are so many interesting things to talk
about.
Tangential analogy to the idea of breaking news, this has been a heck of a crazy week.
Oh, it's been, something else.
And we're going to talk a little bit about, just briefly, even though when I posted this story, things weren't looking so bad in Ukraine or the Donbass, but we'll touch on that briefly. And of course, I'm saying that though it means very little on the world stage, the folks here at Radio Science News stand with Ukraine, partly because I have relatives in Ukraine. And so
let's just say this. When the bully comes in and wants your lunch money, you gotta punch them in the nose.
Well,
if not, they're gonna be there taking your lunch money and everyone else's lunch money forever. Gotta put an end to the bullies. I just want to say that.
I will let you put it. Now, of course,
long experience.
Or at least the other thing is that there should be a mechanism where you can immediately force negotiation upon the bullies and have a cease and desist. And
exactly.
Some of those things are being worked out. We don't want to get too deeply into that because, there's a lot. We have a lot of things on the topic list here, and we're going to try to jump. the one of them that I got from my good friend Robert Strong. Oh, wait a minute, that was you.
That was me.
And this is local news. When Father Michael was talking about big news in Ohio, this is like from Fox News. Robert, this is Fox News in Cleveland, Ohio. You sent this to me, and I said, we're going to use this as a starting point for the, we have a biannual discussion.
Yes, we do.
Twice
a
year.
Every time that we have to turn the clocks either forward or back, I go on a rant that lasts for days.
Well, I will try
to be good. I will try.
Well, first of all, I have gotten so many pop-ups.
Because this is so stupid.
I've had it with this daddy.
It's just ridiculous.
I will read the headline, and then I'll let you sort of comment on it.
Okay.
According to this one, it says daylight savings time. Because, see, you want to get rid of it. But this is also a semantic issue.
Yes.
They're saying, we want to make it permanent. No.
Right.
See, the reason is Robert has never really said that he's, I'm not against the idea.
I'm not
that,
against keeping one time, I'm against changing it twice a year.
Daylight savings time, the term is like a strange term. But it says, here's the latest on where the bill stands to make it permanent. In other words, what they're really saying is we're going to quit doing this.
We are going to quit changing it. We are going to keep one time.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. Keep it simple.
And so this is posted February 22nd, 2022. Columbus, Ohio, it's almost that time again to spring forward and gain an hour of daylight. Daylight savings time begins Sunday, March 13th, when clocks will roll forward and will lose an hour of sleep. but it's another sign that spring is right around
the corner. Now, wait, see, they couch this in like something that we're all looking forward to, so, you know, spring.
Sure.
But see, my English teacher, I'm going to give a shout out to my wonderful English teacher, Mrs. Belton. The first sentence here, it's almost that time to spring forward and gain an hour of daylight. No. We are gaining hours of daylight
the
so-called night, because there are things that happen with celestial mechanics and the perturbations of space and the solar system that mean we have seasons, spring and summer, and
without equinox, etc. Changing the time, we're still getting extra daylight.
This is like, this is obfuscation.
Yes.
This is mendacity.
Poorly written obfuscation.
No, anyway. Yes. The point is that there were some theoretical reasons for doing this. Like I said, we don't want to spend more time than necessary on this.
And I will be good. I just wanted to say that if for no other reason, today's human beings living in this changing clock era,
right?
When the days get longer, you suddenly start to appreciate, gee, there really are seasons. And then all of a sudden, somebody pulls the rug out from under you and says, oh, well, let's change the time. And then all of a sudden, everything's
different. Let's go back to 1919. No, that's a different thing.
And so what I'm saying is that it is getting us further away from reality when we're just namby-pamby changing the time twice a year. For a convenience that was convenient after World War I.
Yeah.
It's no longer convenient.
Well, here's the only thing that's just really weird about this. And they're right. We simply no longer need the biannual tradition of changing our clocks.
No.
It's not a question of needing it, because originally there were theories that, this helps agriculture. It helps.
Right.
You can harvest more and all that kind of stuff by changing the time. The problem is everything in our world is so time related.
Exactly.
The idea that everybody, I could go through multiple reasons why, we missed the church service, or we got there for an hour early. But rather than talk about the myriad things that people have to deal with, the fact that, you know, it takes you a while to get used to waking up.
It does.
Or that you used to feed your dog at a certain time. Now
and
he's
the
going,
dog
why
goes,
you
look,
fed me?
What is wrong with you? And you can't explain to the dog, well, it's daylight savings time.
See, chickens understand this because they do this. But
you can't explain it to your dog.
I'm just going to ask each one of you to think of yourself as one of two things, a teacher or a student.
Yes.
And if you are a teacher, oh, my gosh, you know what the
is a horror scene.
Well, you just know that for a week or so till everybody gets adjusted, it's going to be weird. And if you're a student, it's the same thing. So anyway, Robert, what I don't like about this is they're pushing the concept that you would like, which would be to say, let's no longer change it back and forth. But they're going to call it the Sunshine Protection Act of 2021, as if you're really getting two scoops of ice cream here.
I am?
No, you're not.
Oh, I'm not. Oh,
because all of a sudden now we're going to have DST instead of EST. You're thinking, couldn't you just decide not to change it?
Not to change it.
Let's just say,
stop changing it.
It
alone.
What they're trying to say is that we're giving you permanent daylight savings time, which means almost like, you mean we're going to have more sunshine? And this is
the same amount of sunshine. It's just that you are going to leave the clock set off an hour.
They could have called this, if it ain't broke, don't fix it act.
That's exact. Or just leave it alone act.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. I agree.
But the idea that we're permanently transitioning to daylight savings time, it's going to be confusing because you know there are a lot of people who never go to daylight savings time. So you're gonna end up with state to state issues. I think it's very simple just to go, let's not change. And somebody go, but where are we not changing it from? I want to leave it as more sunshine, Robert. But you want more darkness?
No.
I can see what's wrong
so
with you.
So what what should happen is we should go to the middle of every time zone, and at spring, you should say, okay, this is the day and night are equal length.
Exactly.
Wait until the sun is the highest in the sky. Call that local noon and set your clocks. and that would be it.
And then don't
that's
change
all,
it.
Folks, that's all that you have to do. Wait until spring. Wait until the sun is the highest in the sky. Call that noon. Set your clock to 12 noon. And then you're done. You don't need to go anything else. And that is going to tell you what time it really is.
Well, I like your bill better than theirs. So I'm just
going
to leave it.
My bill is the do it right bill.
Do it right.
Yeah. Dudley's. It's not complicated. In fact, I just want to say, before we even had time zones, every city had their own time zone.
Oh, thanks.
What they did was exactly what I just said. They waited until spring or fall, the first day of spring or fall. And what they did, when the sun was the highest in the sky that day, it was equal day and night. They would call that noon, and every city in the United States and Europe had its own time zone. The problem was that when the trains started moving people around fast enough.
I was going to tell you, in case you didn't know that, I was going to tell you.
So when the trains started moving people around fast enough, it got very confusing because you you had to keep changing your watch every stop.
Yeah.
And that didn't work out well. So what they did, they said, oh, okay, what if we adopt a time zone thing? That's perfectly fine. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the
thing
is,
then we took that, which was a good solution, and we
chopped it up. Well, yeah, for example, for people that are deeply into astronomy, they understand that universal time basically corresponds with the so-called Greenwich Mean Time.
Right.
Where some folks in England who thought that they should control everything.
Because, of course, they did.
Because at the time they did. They established that as the starting point.
Right.
But the main thing that Robert is certainly advocating for here is that whatever, and there, you know, maybe people could argue about where you would set it up.
Right. Whatever time you choose, leave it.
Yeah.
Just leave it. And you know what? I guarantee. In fact, I will. This is a Robert Strong guarantee.
Ooh.
I guarantee to you.
It's worth the
that within the year you will go. I finally understand the seasons.
Yeah.
Because I can watch watch the clock and I can watch the sun, and suddenly there's not the confusion of the disruption twice a year of moving the clock. And so suddenly you go, wow, the days really do get longer in a nice,
that's right,
a dead-y thing. And then they are in midsummer the longest, and then they get shorter again. And there's this beautiful sine wave cycle that we have been missing since 1918. And it would be nice to get back to that.
Well, it certainly would. And you know what, Robert? Some people may even notice that the sun rises in different places on the horizon.
Oh, come on.
I'm serious.
Are you serious?
I saw it on it.
I
saw it happen. Okay. Wow. The hydrogen hub was really kind of cool. Now, you know, since we briefly talked about the hydrogen hub, and like I said, the thing that frustrates me mostly is we have looked at, people have called for hydrogen technology for a long time.
Yes.
The hydrogen technology has a lot of really big issues. Like, I mean, I know that one of the things that people will go, well, we could make hydrogen from coal.
Yes, you could.
I am only going to say that in terms of the company MagnaGas, which started off understanding they were looking at just a way to treat sewage.
Right.
Then they found out, well, you know, what about any hydrocarbons in the sewage. People that have talked about treating waste materials, garbage, with big, you know, carbon arc, you know, plasma. Right. Basically, it's like plasma. It's a torrent of electrons and magnet, and it tears. And then things come together as like simple things. Well, so let's just say they took a simple thing like a whole bunch of municipal sewage.
Okay.
And it turns out that a bunch of people, because they didn't have anything better to do, dumped their antifreeze and they let their oil change go right into the thing, and that went to the unit. So here's this terrible soup of everything you can think of, like waste materials, papers, and you know, runoff from a garbage dump. On what they found that they could put this in this torrent of, you know, of carbon arc, you know, dissolution of the materials, and they were excited because one of the things that came out, the obvious thing was all this water was just like sterile
pure water. H2O without anything else in it.
Because it and then the other thing was that everything that was solid material, unlike the when we get the waste material from New Jersey and those places, they can't even use that for agriculture because it has to be retreated to make sure that it's sterile and eliminate microbes and other kind of stuff. Anyway, they were getting the big news was, oh wow, we've got sterile soil materials that could be just put, you know, they can be certified as sterile. You've got water that is certifiably sterile. The other thing was they were finding that of course stuff gases off. So within a container of all this stuff, this arcs bubbling away, they were finding out that they were getting what they were calling magna gas, which was basically a hydrogen-based fuel.
Right.
That of course it just, you know how it is, Robert, if you have liquid and then stuff bubbles to the top.
I've seen that.
You could take it right off and then do things with it.
You can actually It will actually literally come off by itself.
It sort of does.
It turns out that because we live in a gravitational field, the dense stuff goes down and the light stuff, it goes up. It will literally take itself and separate out things.
I knew there was a good reason for living on a planet.
You're absolutely right, yes. Yeah. So because of that, this just works out perfect.
Well, but they basically found out that this material, this magna gas, I don't want to get too complex with it because relative to a hydrogen hub, I mean, one of the things would be, oh, it's great to have just pure hydrogen because we can do stuff with it. But the magna gas itself was a sort of it was hydrogen-based and contained, you know, other gas, but it was like a high-grade material. So the first thing that they
you could sell
or you could burn or you could cook with. So when they started thinking, what can we do with this gas, which seems to burn at a much higher temperature, the first thing they did, and again, I'm saying, you know, if you want to get your Google machine and look at magna gas, it's got some complex turns and tosses and turns as far as the corporate and all that, but the first product they came up with was a gas that competes directly with acetylene.
Right.
Except that it's not heavy. It doesn't sink.
It's not acetylene.
It doesn't sink to places in pools so that if you throw your cigarette in, it blows up your whole place.
See, the interesting thing is that if you use that gas to burn, what comes off of it? Carbon dioxide, right?
Yeah, well, acetylene, but if you're burning a hydrogen-based fuel.
But if you burn a hydrogen-based fuel that's only hydrogen, what comes off is water vapor.
Yeah.
And your choice, carbon dioxide or water vapor.
So in the case of this thing that they first came off with, it's not pure hydrogen. It's actually sort of a hybrid gas.
Exactly.
But it burns extremely hot, extremely clean, extremely safe. You can cut through like 6-inch bars of steel when, you know. But the other part of it is, by just tweaking the process and putting a little more money into the production, it can produce pure hydrogens, including hydrogens which may be more transmissible and usable in fuel cells, cars, etc.
So, folks, what Richard's saying, and we've talked about this multiple times if you've listened to Radio Science News over the years, that you can take municipal waste, the stuff when you flush your toilet, this stuff, if you can take this, apply this process, and what comes out is distilled water,
sterile soil,
a usable soil that you can put right on your garden, and the third component that gases out is a welding gas.
Yeah, for cutting.
Unlike
torches.
Anything else.
In a head-to-head with acetylene.
Yes. It's unlike anything else that when you use it, it doesn't give off carbon dioxide. It's literally hydrogen, but multiple hydrogen molecules combined to make a larger molecule, which means that you can this thing through.
And it doesn't leak.
Right, because it's not going to make metal brittle.
Oh, and for
it's a win-win-win-win-win-win-win. It's why every municipal little town in the world is not doing this is beyond me.
Well, there are some
reasons. I just do not understand.
It certainly goes into the complex relationship between business, government, and all that stuff too.
Wouldn't it be fantastic if when you flushed your toilet, you knew that what was coming back to you in your water line was literally distilled water?
No. One would think.
Would that be amazing?
Now, the reason why this is such a pertinent topic today is the other thing. We talked about this last week before things got really bad in the Ukraine. We talked about how we had discussions with our good friend Howard Monroe, and I basically made the statement that, look, all these political things that we're fussing and fighting about and wars and going to, they're basically related to energy.
It's all about energy.
So not to get too deep into that, I'm going to go immediately to the chart, way over here on the right. You can bypass the virus and skip around the circle of the graphene.
Off the graphene. Okay.
So let's just go to the chart, because one of the things that I'm just going to say, everybody gets frustrated and everybody gets to that thing. They go, I don't know. I feel like it's some modification of a bad Winnie the Pooh satire where people go, "Oh, what can you do?
It'll never happen.
The Eeyore thing. Yeah. So the chart that I'm just throwing up here is from your good friends at Gas Buddy, Robert.
Oh, Gas Buddies.
This was on the Kelley Blue Book chart. I was looking at something on Kelley
Blue Book. It's giving me on the vertical y-axis regular gas price U.S. dollars per gallon.
Dollars per gallon.
And then the x-axis, the horizontal, is time. Yeah, okay, looks cool. Like a reasonably good graph. Well, it starts from $2.09 and goes all the way up to $3.59. And since November of 2020, this has essentially been a straight line. There have been some ups and downs.
Yeah.
But it's gone from $2.09 up to $3.59.
Okay, and I'll stop right there, because I will say anybody will quickly recognize that the very bottom of it will be the period of time where, well, you know, gas had gone. I was going to say part of what you're seeing here is the reemergence of business, people traveling, yada yada yada. You know, because we're emerging from a whole COVID thing.
Yeah, sure.
And so, and then people would go, well, sure. As anybody, any Keynesian economist will tell you, Robert, that this reflects its supply and demand.
Okay.
And so the idea is has the supply really changed around the world? No. It's basically a glut around
it's
the world.
It's the same thing.
But they're saying that there's
some reason it's gone from 209 to 359.
Well, and but what I'm going to say
over November 2020 to the current date.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying the long-term thing that I would even be willing to say to people, okay, so you've bought into this whole supply and demand thing, right?
But it doesn't seem to no. be working here.
Well, but here's
because
the part.
Because when demand goes down, doesn't prices go down?
Yeah, well, no.
Okay, and when demand goes up.
It did go down during COVID back here.
Sure.
But what the part that I'm frustrated about right now, and I'm just like a point in time issue with me, and you can think about it yourself. I saw it this morning as I drove through my gas station territory in Bethlehem, West Virginia.
Your gas station territory.
Well, all of a sudden, when there's bad news, I don't know, like somebody might be cutting off their gas lines, or somebody might attack a country, or the Nord Stream 2, there might be a submarine crew from some place that goes down and blows up the bottom of it. On the idea that, there's going to be a shortage. So do you think that the supply shortage has hit any process yet? No.
Probably not.
No. But do you know what happened immediately? Like this morning, 5 cents a gallon in my little neighborhood.
I just want to say that I've been watching my gas prices in my neighborhood, and they've actually gone down a couple cents in the last couple days.
When you go back home today, Robert.
Okay.
But anyway, the point that I would love to have people look at is the buy-in to the fact that as soon as anything that looks like bad news, everybody's like, well, we've got to predict the future and we've got to prepare for it. Mm-hmm. And everybody understands that if the price of transportation fuel goes up, they'll go, that means everything
has to go up. So now that gives me the go ahead to be able to rise to raise every price that in my store.
Right. So the thing I'm going to say is, even if everybody wants to accept that these prices are always about supply and demand and kinks in the supply chain and on and on and on and on, I will stipulate that that's okay. We'll believe that's true.
Let's believe that.
As long as you don't go and say, Well, you know, well, there's the big demand, but you know, the supply hasn't changed because Saudi Arabia decided not to put any more out there.
Right.
And so instead of like, you know, saying, oh, well, what can you do about that? You know, you go, hey, look, the price is already high. You're already making enough money.
Right.
What, and this will apply
how
to...
How much money do you need?
Well, what it would apply to is just increase your supply and let's right. keep it stable.
Yeah.
Or but if you have other agendas, like you're just trying to convince everybody that...
Wait. Nobody has another agenda.
Well, there are multiple agendas in the world. All right. So, you know what? We do need to touch just briefly. You sent me... actually, there was a link. I think it was a Facebook thing. So I actually have, it may not come up on everybody's computer. Right. When you click the first one, which is Ukraine.
All right.
So I click it on mine. And because I am a Facebook person.
Okay. It says,
you're a Facebook user, yeah. You should be able
so
to see
it. So this is Gretchen Harris Suter.
Yeah. She actually, and this is actually without, because she actually.
February 21st. So this was. Like 5 days ago.
Yeah.
So why is Russia after Ukraine? For those who ask, why does Ukraine matter?
And this is before anything happened.
This is why Ukraine matters. And
just touch on some of these.
My wife said, Robert, I need to read you this. So I'm just going to start reading here. It says, this is why Ukraine matters. Being the second largest country in area in Europe, it has a population of over 40 million. Folks, it's 44.1. But,
yeah.
Okay. Ukraine ranks first in Europe in proven recoverable reserves of uranium ores.
Mm.
Second place in Europe and 10th place in the world in terms of titanium ore reserves.
Ooh,
second place in the world in terms of explored reserves for manganese ores, 2.3 billion tons or 12% of the world's reserves. Second largest iron ore reserves in the world, 30 billion tons. Second place in Europe in terms of mercury ore reserves. Third place in Europe, 13th place in the world in shale gas reserves.
Okay. So let's stop right there for a second.
22 trillion with a T cubic meters.
Okay, so we'll start. The thing is, this is a really amazing long list.
And it goes on and on and on. The reason that Putin wants Ukraine is that if you want to be a powerful Russia, you need these resources.
Yeah. Well, let's stop.
And so he's taking it because of the resources. He's also taking it because there's 44 hardworking people that would suddenly become his slaves, essentially.
Well, it's not mince words. No.
So no. I'm not.
I agree with you.
I'm mincing words.
But I want to stop for a second.
They would become
just apropos of what we were talking about, how so many things are political, in terms of energy. Now, when you scroll through this, you also find
it
out
goes on and on and on.
Because my grandfather, who was raised in the Ukraine, told me of endless stories of how they worked the wheat fields because they were the breadbasket of Europe.
Were.
And
there was a place that oh here,
just about how this many people they can feed.
Right.
Yeah,
this is what blows my mind. Ukraine can meet the food needs of 600 million people. Do you know how many people live in current Russia?
Not that many.
149 million.
You there's your lunch bucket right
so
there.
So Ukraine can meet the food needs of four Russias. That's why they want this.
Well, okay, it's just because there's so much to go through here. I want to pick out two things from this.
Okay.
Now, the first one was the one you already mentioned. So let's just, you mentioned the one about the natural gas
right.
one more time. What does that say up there about natural gas?
That it
there it is.
Reserves 22 trillion cubic meters.
So you're saying
so
that
it ranks third place in Europe, 13th place in the world in shale gas reserves.
Okay, so if I were like, say, a professor at the University of Mexico, I would say mucho gaso, right?
Mucho gaso,
okay,
yes.
Now, here, I want you to scroll.
If you spoke really bad Spanish.
But now, right. See, I was scrolling down to look. I went past the thing of cheese exports and
right.
the chicken food,
it's
blah,
also,
blah, blah.
It's also seventh place in the world in coal reserves.
Well, okay. But I want to be specific here.
Okay.
Because a lot of times I have noticed that people can't seem to hold too many things in their head
That's
at
true.
Once. So you've already told me that they've got mucho gaso, right?
Mucho
well,
gaso.
According to Professor, what's his name, down in the Mexico University. So they've got mucho. But now, I'm looking down. I go, well, you know, a lot of places in Europe. We mentioned this last week. We said, you know, Europe has embarked on a lot of green energy, and that's a wonderful thing. But if you and I were going to forget the whole green energy thing just for the transitional period to get through this problem, we would say, well, but what if they could find natural gas? You have already told me that they have mucho gas, right?
Mucho gas.
I think that's your quote from your...
Says, I believe his name is Sven.
All right. So when you went down here below your chicken, eggs, and cheese imports, and the right where you said Ukraine could meet the food needs of 600 million people.
600 million. That just blows my mind.
They transitioned to industrialization. I want you to look
Europe's at... Europe's second... and world's fourth largest natural gas pipeline system.
So wait, let me see if I have these two components.
I think you do.
You're telling me that you could have mucho gaso.
Mucho gaso.
And mucho pipo.
Mucho pipo, yes.
It started to sound like a bad Saturday.
Actually, it sounds like Groucho Marx
is what it
sounds like.
So,
being that you have the gas and you've got the pipeline stuff, pump it.
So you mean if somebody were competing with you, They would rather not.
Who
could possibly?
Who sends gas pipelines into Europe?
Who's holding the world hostage right now?
30% of Russia's economy comes from its gas pipelines.
Well, it's 30%. Like, it's like their only game
and
in town.
It's the only game in town, yes.
All right.
And so what they're looking across the border and going, these people have more resources than we do. They've got a giant chunk of land. They've got all these hardworking people, and they've got gas pipelines already in place. Why don't we just go steal it?
Yeah, why don't we just screw things up? Okay, now, the only thing I'm going to say is
bully.
That when I got this story from you, knowing that it was on Facebook,
yes,
that I found myself saying, yeah, I don't know if I want to trust this story because, you know, I can't get this thing to my thing to back up. So I was looking for another. The other thing was I don't like it when I see a story that they don't have a link to or an attribution.
Right, sure.
As a science person, you and I are a little bit picky about
true.
That. So I'm going to say I'm not even going to accept all that stuff.
Okay.
So I went to
the
I found this is something interesting I didn't know about the whole situation. I went to Forbes.
Okay.
And it says, as Russian forces roll to eastern Ukraine, Putin grabs yet another prize. Ores and energy. So now there's a big video, there's a picture of the Donbass. I didn't realize what the word Donbass actually meant. And it says, I'll just read this first part because this validates what you were saying, but it focuses mostly just on what are going to be the commodity items that are going to trade and the Forbes people are going to carry, or what are the oligarchs going to worry about, you know? It says, when Russian military forces began moving into the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk, they began to regain a long-missed prize, the Donbass. So we've been hearing that tossed around.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the word Donbass is really a short for Donetsk coal basin.
It's one of the largest mining regions in Europe. Coal reserves under its rolling plains cover approximately 9,000 square miles, or 23,300 square kilometers, south of the Donetsk rivers
and to the Dnieper.
And deposits also extend upward into the Dnieper River.
So when you're hearing Donetsk or Donbass, basically you're talking about a huge area of coal reserves. Now, you know, the thing is, everything we just talked about, I just have to add one more point about the Magna Gas conversation.
Please.
Is Robert and I actually emailed back and forth with the folks at Magna Gas over, and we said, you know, because we were trying to set this thing up as a West Virginia industry.
We were trying.
I pointed out to them over and over again that what they were considering as their feedstock materials were kind of like, they were complicated. They weren't dense. It was like, we've got 3% oil that's in water, or we've got, you know. I said, for heaven's sakes, why don't you come to West Virginia, and you could come right out here to Bethlehem. You could come to one of these places where you have a coal slurry
pond.
And all you do is you just take this liquid material and suck it through your straw into your process and process coal, which is, you know, basically what you would end up with is you would have all of the hydrocarbons would be broken down and reassembled into your Magna Gas. All of the stuff that you don't want, like sulfur, those things would all drop off to the bottom and you could sell those too.
Yep.
So
It's a win-win.
I'm just going to say, just for my own benefit, not that it ever does me any good, that they literally issued a whole patent to do exactly that with particles of plastic or coal.
Yes.
And then they didn't do anything with it.
And
so that's where we
one,
are.
One, I just want to add in here that you're saying that this is also a solution to the plastic pollution problem.
It is, yeah.
I thought so.
Well,
that's what we've been saying again on Radio Science News now for years.
In fact, they talked about it as using plastic first, and I said, look, guys, I said, why not go clean up a coal slurry in wherever?
Right.
And
as you were cleaning up the plastic problem, why don't we also clean up the coal slurry problem?
I'm just going to say they rewrote the patent, and they didn't mention it.
I'm sure they did.
I said, well, thank you very much for
thank you very much
including
for
my idea in your patent.
Including me in the outcome.
Hey, no big problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have really gotten off on not too much on a tangent.
Because, you know
this
what?
This is real time.
This is why we do our show. Is that there are some times in which there are some things that come up that need to be addressed.
Yeah, we don't have to go back and redo the music or add
and
drum tracks or anything.
It isn't as though that our corporate people are going to get upset because it's just you and me.
Okay. Well, look, we have a ton of really exciting things here to look at. I'm just going to say let's click on chilling because I forgot. Oh, I know what it is. This is the one that somebody posted. The story. This is why you don't want
to... I-95 traffic nightmare. What if you were stuck in an electric car for 24 hours?
Well, and it's the big takeaway from a lot of people
interesting.
Electric cars would really screw things up because blah, blah, blah. This is an article that basically goes, did anybody actually go back and look at what would happen?
What would happen? So a rapid early January storm created a unique traffic nightmare for hundreds of drivers in Virginia. Interstate 95, the East Coast primary north-south highway corridor, came to a complete standstill just south of Washington, D.C. By the way, I lived about a mile from
95.
I went to Washington all the time, so I know right where this is. Hundreds of drivers sat trapped in their cars for as long as 24 hours, waiting for a tow trucks to clear away a series of accidents.
So here we get to the question, because you know what science people do, Robert? They ask questions.
Yeah. So many assume that the EVs would run out of stored electricity long before the gasoline-powered cars would run out of gas. I say no. I think that the EV cars are going to last longer.
Well, let me just go further.
Because they're more efficient.
A whole bunch of people said, it says many assume that this would be an argument. This would show... That said here, theory create medical risk for drivers and passengers. Even drive, if they made it through the night, they need you'd be towed to the nearest charging station.
Sure.
So the whole point was the initial argument was to make a negative argument to say that this is why we are not ready for electric cars. Now, because we're going to be short on time, I'm just going to say. When you go back and actually look through this, you find out that, it basically talks about the fact that if you have an electric car, you can, for the most part, what you do is you just put it into only using the heat to heat your cabin and your chair and your cab.
So if you've got a car that runs on a gasoline, the gasoline car, you have to run it, and you're getting a little of the heat back, but an electric car, you can only run the heater, and you can turn everything else off.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Well, but that's the whole point. When you go back and look through this whole article, what you find is that they went back and just did some really, like here, running the heater on an internal combustion car requires running the entire engine.
Right, exactly.
Each gasoline engine burns fuels at different rates, but there's no way to set the engine, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
An electrical vehicle, when it is quote unquote idling, is draining the battery extremely slow as only the heater uses electricity.
Only the heater is being turned on as opposed to the car being turned on.
Yeah, so the gist of the article is they go back and give you more exact numbers. But, you know, some cars were out there for 18 or 24 hours and then still had enough power to drive away with 100, you know.
Right.
So anyway, look through this and, of course...
Cool. I am interested to see that.
And because I know that you were certainly getting pretty excited when I talked about the sub-dwarves.
Oh,
And of course,
I want to know about subjects.
And also, I'm going to have another shout out to my English teacher. Mrs. Belton would say, I need to explain to you that the plural of dwarf is not dwarfs. But astronomers don't always know that. So
No. Now
this is something, Robert, that you may have not seen, because I think it just came up. This is something, also, it's about a whole new class of stars. And you're going, what? So this is talking about the fact that, I'm having my little thing circling here. Of course, it's got this wacky picture. It says a carbon and oxygen-rich star with a helium-burning core may arise from the merger of two dead stars called white dwarfs.
Dwarfs,
as they say here. So first of all, I'm just thinking about this. So now, a white dwarf is something that's very specific to astronomy, right, Robert?
Right.
And it says...
It is a star that is about the size of the Earth. It's made out of a matter that has been squeezed, not squeezed all the way down as far as you can squeeze matter, but it's pretty dense stuff.
Yeah. Well, the thing that they ran into, it says, two newfound fireballs that burn hundreds of times as bright as the sun and happen to be covered with carbon and oxygen,
okay,
which are the ashy byproducts of not just hydrogen fusion, but helium fusion.
Helium fusion, right.
Belong to this new class of stars that they're discussing. It says, though the blazing orbs are not the first stellar bodies found covered in carbon and oxygen, analysis of the light emitted by the stars suggests they are the first that also have helium-burning cores. So helium fusion is the source of their energy.
Their energy. Wow, that's really cool.
That's really awesome.
I have been seeing little snippets about this, that some folks have been looking at some of the white dwarfs, which they thought were essentially kept warm just because they were stars that had collapsed.
Yeah, yeah.
They were under the impression that they had stopped a fusion.
Radiating.
Right, but we're just slowly cooling off. Yeah. Well, now we're finding out that, lo and behold, these are actually stars.
Well, and the thing that's so cool, there, again, a lot of this will require further research. But they, by examining the spectroscopy and everything, they were realizing, and the mechanism, this kind of explains this, says such a merger would have produced. Oh, they say these two white dwarfs had already been orbiting one another, but they gradually grew closer over time. Eventually, the helium-rich white dwarf gobbled up its partner, spewing carbon and oxygen all over the surface, just as a messy child might get food all over his face.
Oh, I have seen that. Yeah,
so, yeah, that's me. That's me all at lunchtime. Such a merger would have produced a stellar body which is covered in carbon and oxygen, but with enough mass to reignite the nuclear fusion in its core, causing it to burn hot and glow brilliantly.
Wow.
And so, they've gone through the explanation of how
they set up a test
of this theory, and
As I said, in the last couple months, I've heard a couple little snippets about this, but this is just awesome.
This is a really cool article, and when you think about again, one of the things we always talk about is we think of our sun and the idea of hydrogen fusing,
right.
And we understand that the nuclear theories of all this. Helium then fuses, and then other things fuse. So, we only have about two. We only have about a couple of minutes left. But let's take a quick look at math neurons.
Okay, math neurons.
Because you're like a math guy, Robert.
Yeah, I sure do try.
Apparently, from what this article is saying, that you may actually have at least two neurons that are doing different things.
Uh-oh.
I can see we're going to run out of time, but I'm just going to read. The brain has neurons that fire specifically during certain mathematical operations. The findings indicate that some of the neurons detected are exclusively used during addition, while others are only active during subtractions.
It's bizarre.
They respond in the same manner whether the calculation instruction is written as word or symbol. So, in other words, they were doing all these real complex PET scan kind of things.
Yeah.
And what they're finding out is that there actually are neurons. And again, this is, I love their little picture.
That are only when they add, and there are neurons only when they subtract.
Which is a weird
thing.
Oh, it's time to start some music here.
Okay.
Right here. Oh, listen to that music, Ross.
I love that.
I'll turn it down. So you're saying that in my brain, when I'm doing addition, I use one part of my brain, and when I do subtraction, I'm using another part of my brain. Well, that I don't have a math part. I've got math parts.
And it may be, and the thing I'm also looking at is they don't indicate whether these things are exclusively in touch with each other.
Right.
And, you know, coordinate further. It's just that this is the first Grant Robert.
They'll
they'll be using a bunch of neurons to figure out how much money to request for the next grant.
For the next grant. Hey, speaking of next grants.
Yeah, speaking of next grant, listen, Radio Science News. RadioScienceNews.org gives you all the information you need up there to know, you know, how you can listen to this show and even listen to it more than once during a week.
So, and just because we didn't get to it today doesn't mean you can't do it now.
Yeah,